Welcome to CBSSports.com basketball podcast, the Pick and Troll podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. I have a special guest for this Friday podcast that we are recording Thursday night because I'll be away on Friday. I've got Ethan Sherwood Strauss from Bleacher Report, from Hoop Speak. He's the fashionista of the basketball Twitter world. Ethan, how's it going?
Oh, you dirty liar, you. I hope this is special in the good sense, and not the bad sense, as a special guest. And should I out the fact that we were just laughing about how I couldn't identify a vest versus a rain jacket?
That's, right, I mean, that's a confusing thing. Your excuse was, I don't know fashion. But, I mean, that's it really is just identifying if something has sleeves or not.
Well, let me tell you this, Zach. You know how fish at the bottom of the ocean, they start losing certain senses they don't need?
Sure.
They're exposed to a lot. They lose vision because there's no light down there. Well, I'm holed up in this apartment, click-clacking away at the keyboard. You start to lose your sense of the world, the sense of what is and isn't a sleeve. It all blends together, and that is my excuse for now. I'm just losing senses because I'm the basketball blogging equivalent of the fish at the bottom of the ocean.
I felt like I was losing just like common sense today because I was driving and it's quite icy here in Minneapolis and I witnessed a car accident. And I actually had to think, do I have to stop and be a witness right now? Which made me feel kind of like an idiot because I think it's illegal. Is that illegal? I don't even know.
I don't think it is. I know it was illegal in Seinfeld. There was a Good Samaritan law.
Yeah.
Episode,
I don't know these laws here.
Yeah, well, how do you not know the laws where you live? You're criticizing me for not knowing my fashion. You don't know the laws and whether or not you'll get arrested for keeping driving. Now, this sounds remarkably cynical and not a good way to look at it, but there's always plausible deniability so long as you say, hey, you know, I'm a very oblivious person. I'm a basketball blogger. Maybe you don't know, but we start to lose our senses like fish at the bottom of the ocean. I didn't see the accident. I think they believe you.
I think that's exactly what happened. Is if a cop happened to witness me witnessing the accident, and I didn't stop. He comes and pulls me over, and I just say, "Hey, look, officer, I'm a fish at the bottom of the ocean here. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what to tell you."
I believe your listeners need to be instructed on how to get away with general law breaking. It's a good message to put forth. It's always good to plead ignorance. Ignorance is a great defense. Whenever I'm pulled over, I just pretend to have never been where I am, and I'm lost. And then I try to flip it on the cop. It's not very manly, but I try to flip it on the cop where I'm trying to find my friend's place at this address, and I just try to kind of coax them into helper role as opposed to enforcer role in order to get out of the ticket.
That's really some next level trolling of police officers. I'm actually impressed.
Well, you know, sometimes you have to do what you have to do. One of the advantages of living in Oakland is that they don't care about little stuff like that. But when I'm outside, when I'm in the suburbs, you can actually get pulled over for chicken-ass things.
We will eventually talk basketball in this podcast, but one thing I did enjoy, I grew up in Northern California, and my sister lived in San Francisco for quite a while, and one of my favorite things was going to visit her in San Francisco and learning that there are no traffic rules in San Francisco. It's Thunderdome. You just do what you want.
Yeah, there are no rules. I remember that Bomani Jones set some conference out here, and he saw people smoking marijuana on the steps of City Hall, and y'all don't care, do you? Yeah, that's true. There are laws in the sense that there are laws elsewhere in the Bay Area. It's pretty cool.
So before we talk about basketball on the court, let's talk about a little basketball off the court. Our buddy, John Hollinger, got hired away from ESPN to be the vice president of basketball operations for the Memphis Grizzlies. What do you feel about this?
I think everybody's a liar. Everybody does this thing where they go, oh my God, I'm so happy about this. This is so, you're a liar. And in this sense, you're a liar because you love John Hollinger so much.
Right.
I am depressed right now. I'm drinking, you can't see it, but I'm drinking red wine out the bottle right now on my Thursday night. Because I have no work tomorrow. Tomorrow's my day off, but it's also because I'm depressed because I need that daily John Hollinger. I need it. It's just a staple. I don't know how long he's been doing this. It feels like maybe 7 years, 8 years, I'm not sure. But I'm so used to having that wake up in the morning, read over what Hollinger put together and his unique mastery of the league and his way of putting it. And I don't know what I'm going to be able to do with myself with him moving on to the Grizzlies. It's great for him. It's terrible for me.
I have this little fantasy that it will get me to be connected somehow in the NBA, that where I'll have a source. And he'll just, for some reason, without any real necessity, he'll just call me up one day. He doesn't even have my phone number. He'll find it, though. He'll call me up and he'll say, "Hey, Zach, I'm trading Zach Randolph. I thought you should be the first to know."
That's a good idea. And I'm sure that I'm sure that's a smart, practical way to look at it. I never thought about using Hollinger as a source. For whatever reason, I was too naive. I thought about how people are saying, "Oh, this means that, you know, you can be hired by a team if you write about it." And I was even making some of that noise, but now that I think about it, it's, "Oh, all you have to do is be the best basketball writer of all of them and invent your own statistics, your own proprietary statistics and all these different ranking services. That's all you have to do, and then you can get hired." It's not exactly a lot of reason to hope for all of us.
Yeah, it seems like a very simple process.
Yeah, just be really, really, really awesome.
Yeah, hardworking, be smart, be innovative, and that's all it takes. And, you know, that's not hard to do.
Well, not to. I want to move it away from me and my selfishness.
No, you don't. Don't pretend. Don't. You called me out last time you were on the show. By the way, you're our first 2-time guest. How's that? That means you are a special guest. But last time you called me out saying that I wasn't. I was showing some faux humbleness, some faux humility. You do not want to take this away from you.
I do like talking about me, but because I've learned to better socialize myself somewhat. Despite losing a lot of my senses, I really focus on Hollinger and his legacy because I'm a little bit shaken up. I'm a little bit emotional about this. Man, it was instructive as to how I thought about the NBA and changing the way I thought about the NBA years ago and creating a platform by which other people can do it. And the whole time, his writing is great writing. It's not numbers. And that skill of being able to weave in statistics, weave it into a narrative, is very difficult. It's something I struggle with. The art tends to suffer when you do that. Guys like Hollinger and Haberstroh, who can turn numbers into a narrative, it's a special skill. And he was one of the first to do it, and he still does it admirably.
And I don't think people realize like how many words he cranks out in a week. And to have them all be really good words and really smart and looking at the league a little bit differently, that's difficult to do.
Yeah, I haven't talked to him. I respect the hell out of Hollinger, but I don't know him that well. I would imagine that perhaps there was some burnout. Maybe not. I might be talking out of school here, and he possibly looked at this as just a better opportunity to do something new. But to be that has to wear on you, and he must have been very self-motivated at the same time, because there's no way anybody would be demanding that he do that.
I mean, let me tell you, as someone who ran a chat for 2 years every night, I can pretty much relate to his entire process.
That's something I always wanted to ask you about, and I never really did, even though we talk a lot. How did that feel to be in this strange technological emotional space of the Daily Dime live chat, and to just be in it all the time for 2 years? And it moves so quickly, and you're trying to be funny while at the same time take other information and off the TV and all these different games, and also not get fired by letting something slip. What were the pressures of that like? And what, just, did it wear on you? Was it great at the beginning? What did it feel like?
It was a grind. It was a good grind, but it was a grind. It was something that, you know, around after the All-Star break and after the trade deadline, I would kind of like mentally check out, because it was a lot to do. every night, and it was a lot of the same conversations that just kind of wears on you. But then the playoffs would happen, and it's like it was this complete like refreshing moment where like I just completely recharged my the adrenaline was back. I was like back to loving what I was doing, and that kind of helped. So like to be able to break it up like that to, you know, games that matter, and then the games towards the end of the season matter, but kind of stop caring a little bit unless it's a big game, and then the games absolutely matter once the playoffs start. And that was like a good way to break it up. But it's weird to have to, when you're as socially inept and reluctant as I am, it is very weird to have to lead a conversation every night, because I really don't like talking to people.
Yeah, no, I have that problem too. I'm far more, especially strangers. I like talking to you, but other people, just when you meet people for the first time, feigning interest in their lives, I found that process to be quite difficult. I'm not good at it, and I'm clearly faking it when I do. So I'm glad that you got to grow that skill a little bit, at least.
Yeah, I feel like I did a little bit. But that's the thing is, like, unless you care about basketball, I feel like a jackass telling someone what I do when I meet them. Because if they don't care about basketball, it's just nonsense to them.
Yes, yes. I've encountered that problem. You know what I think is intriguing is that the playoffs refreshed you. And that might not be obvious to somebody who doesn't do this, but we genuinely love the sport. And what's often draining is that there's an element of being a liar, what we do, which is wringing entertainment out of these spaces of the season that aren't fundamentally very important or even entertaining. And you just have to do it. So you have to keep churning. And so I believe, because we're watching TNT in the background and Carmelo Anthony just got flagrantly fouled, we'll keep you retroactively updated on that.
Yeah.
I believe that's why Charles Barkley's burned out on his job.
Yeah, and I actually, that's a good point because, he's kind of said as much that he doesn't really want to do the studio gig anymore and he likes calling games. And you do, it's kind of a weird dynamic. Like, how could you get tired of doing that? But if he wasn't planning on doing that long term, then he would need a change of direction, right?
I heard him on the Dan Le Batard show and he was saying that as part of his explanation, he sounded bored. He said, man, I could eliminate 99% of the teams right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone's saying that this team has a chance, they don't. This team has a chance, they don't. And you could tell that he was bored because the NBA regular season is this long march. And for the most part, although the Lakers have thrown a surprise at us, we know who the final teams are. We know who the teams are who can win. And so I think the absurdity of it all might have seeped into Barkley's psyche, and he just got sick of chopping it up, you know, on the, it's not a dais. What is that? What is that desk that they all sit behind?
I think it's like a Uber podium game.
Yeah, Uber podium game. To sit up there and to continue to try to talk about the Brooklyn Nets or these also-ran teams and this and that, it just got tiring and probably absurd. Maybe if the NBA was a little bit sleeker in its design, it wouldn't have bored Barkley so much.
So, talking about teams that have a chance to contend, what about these New York Knicks? I mean, I keep thinking like, nah, there's no way, but they keep playing well. I like their mode of attack. They're kind of a chucking team, but it's all, you know, pretty much predicated on ball movement and spacing, which, you know, has worked in the past. Carmelo's playing really good basketball despite your just illustrious hatred for him. I would call your hatred for him illustrious, and your goal to downgrade what he's doing and to bump up the stature of Tyson Chandler.
Well, I you know what? I'm just gonna cop to this. I severely undersold Carmelo Anthony's talent based on his past production.
Yeah,
and that's something that can happen. You look at what somebody has produced and you define them by it, as opposed to looking at their talent, what they're capable of in a new scenario. I believe I made that mistake with Carmelo Anthony. Now that he he's playing at the four in a spread pick and roll, with that little extra space, he goes from being a pretty good player to an awesome player. And I did not see that coming, and this is why the Knicks are good. I also wonder, how do you feel about this new NBA that's approaching, this Euro-style NBA, where it's four three-point shooters and a big man? Because there's an element of collectivism that, while I enjoy it, and I enjoy not having a legal defense anymore, it feels a little bit too college basketball-ish, a little bit too random, the, hey, whoever hits the most threes wins, and I don't know if I love it.
I'm not sure that it's quite headed to that extreme of like a college basketball style. The one thing I would like about, you know, I don't dislike college basketball, the rhythm of a game. It's that the talent is so bad compared to the NBA that in the, you know, the 35 second shot clock, and it makes the execution of it all really miserable. If you put the best talent in the world out there playing that style in a 24-second shot clock, that might not be such a bad thing.
It might not. But you have to admit that this extra space they get when they take a low post player and make him a three-point shooter, the extra space, it's almost like a PED. Jason Kidd was washed up. Jason Kidd was terrible these past two seasons. Now, I don't know what his true shooting is. Is it like, what, 80%? Something insane? I suppose that's not unnatural, and it's good that we still have Jason Kidd around, and the strategic quirk has produced some exciting basketball. But on some level, I don't like it. Part of me likes it, and part of me doesn't, and I'm just going to have to reconcile with it and embrace the brave new era that we're entering. Only the Grizzlies can save us.
I think what I like about it is that it's so strategically centered now, is that you can't just, I don't think you can go out and just say, here are my best five, you know, let's play ball. Like, you have to say, here are my best five that work within the confines of this system, and this is how we're going to attack. And I like the fact that it's hard to defend pick and rolls, and that everyone seems to run that and adjust off of that in different ways. And that, so you have a focus of what NBA basketball is. It's a pick and roll league at this point, with, you know, shooters spreading the floor to give you space. But with the way you can defend it by, you know, playing pseudo zones and having legitimate help defensive schemes, I've never even played chess in my life, which seems impossible, but it seems like it's a chess match in a way.
It's funny that you say that. I hope you're right. I really hope you're right, because I was asking Brett Cormanos, who does great work at NBA Playbook and Grantland, breaking down the strategy, is there just a way to crack down on a decently run spread pick and roll four-out strategy? And he goes, no. He's just big on this basketball minimalism. God, that's a hard word to say sometimes.
It is.
Minimalism. And that scares me a little bit. There's no real way to crack down on it and to contain this beast that is the four-out spread pick and roll style. I just worry that we're going to tilt towards something that I don't recognize from my youth.
But do you need to recognize it from your youth?
No. And this is me showing my age.
We've talked about this in the past, of going back and watching old games from the 90s that were just awful. I mean, it's awful basketball.
Yeah, and the people who say that Michael Jordan faced better defenses than today are just wrong. That's just ignorance. That's just, no. And he's the greatest player to ever play.
Yeah.
I'm not denying that. But he faced easier defenses at the same time.
He faced a more, you know, he was in a more physical era, but that, in terms of schematics and I mean, you could hand check a guy, but once he got by you, you know, a defender was eight steps away.
Well, what's more incentivized, not more incentivized, but more rewarded now is shooting. And I wonder, does that change point guard rules? I believe that you didn't need to be a great shooting point guard back in the day. But now, and it looks like Rondo is shooting a bit better this year, it's just really hard to be a good, effective point guard if you're compromising your team's spacing with the way the game is headed and being so space conscious.
I think it depends on I mean, I think you can get away with it if you're not someone that is pressured into shooting. Kind of like Rondo has been over the last few years, even though he's improving. You know, he's never really felt pressured to put up shots when he's left open, and it kind of keeps possessions alive and keeps the options open. And you know, I think we saw similar things with Jason Kidd before he improved his shooting. You know, when he was in New Jersey, that was kind of the thing he did is, yeah, he couldn't shoot, but he found a way to attack and take away space from the defense to open up space for his teammates. And I think the special point guards who maybe can't shoot but can figure it out the other way, you know, I'm obviously hoping that Ricky Rubio comes back to health and figures that out. I think that there is a certain market for a non-shooting point guard.
Well, Rondo's in the perfect situation with Kevin Garnett, because Kevin Garnett can shoot, even though he's not a three-point shooter.
Sure.
I just wonder, I would love to, as an experiment, try to put Rondo with DeAndre Jordan and Blake Griffin to see if they sort of even trump that theory and are still good despite the lack of shooting. I'm amazed at what Chris Paul can accomplish with those two non-shooters in the front court. But if it could still be done with somebody like Rajon Rondo, it would make me question some things.
Maybe we'll see that a little bit, depending on how Eric Bledsoe continues to improve. I mean, he's not really a great shooter, and it's, you know, very small doses, but he's pretty effective with those guys.
Yes, that's true.
He's also an athletic freak.
He's an athletic freak. I don't believe that the defense is necessarily keyed on stopping Eric Bledsoe.
Sure.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Though that team is sort of strategically at odds with itself. I believe Beckley's made this point, in that Blake Griffin would really benefit from getting out in the break and having everything go fast. But even though we thought that he would benefit so much from playing with Chris Paul, who's the best player at his position, Chris Paul needs to slow it down, and he needs to be the conductor in that exact manner. And that's not great for Blake Griffin, so they're a little bit strategically at odds. It's good that they're combined. It's good that they're paired, but it's not optimal.
I think it leaves room for Blake Griffin to continue to grow without having to be the focus, because Chris Paul is the focus of that team. And if you take a talent like Blake Griffin, who should be the focus of a team, and put him with make him a second option, I actually think that only benefits his role as a leader, as a player, and as a scorer down the road. I think it's setting them up for a bright future together if they end up staying together.
He's really up there in All-Star voting. He's either second or third. I haven't checked it in a while, and I know we're a ways from the All-Star game. How do you feel about that? You cool with that?
Yeah, I don't put a whole lot of stock in terms of like it being a great accolade anymore because of fan voting. I mean, I'm very against fan voting for bringing players spots on the team. I think if you had coach, you know, and lots of people have thrown out this idea before, but I think if you had coaches or coaches or GMs or somebody compile the teams and then let the fans pick from those 12 who should start, I would be a lot happier with the process.
How would you feel, because Jeremy Lin is doing quite well in the voting despite having a PER of something like 13, how is that going to be rectified? That just feels like an awkward situation for everybody if it comes to pass.
I mean, it's supposed to be the fans' game, correct? So if the fans want to see him,
there are limits. I think they should almost set some sort of bar and say, hey, you got to clear this statistic or you can't. We just can't have you out there. And if you clear that statistic, then yeah, the fans can vote you in. Maybe something like PER, maybe a range of statistics.
Maybe the ballot shouldn't be so wide open. Maybe there should be a limit on, you know, you don't have to have every starter in the league on the ballot or whatever they do now.
I don't want to seem insensitive to China. I know that there's some tension with that. I don't think that a lot of fans like that the Chinese have such a large impact on the voting, especially if something like this happens. I know it will draw up some resentment.
Are you suggesting some kind of 18th and early 19th century voting system of only making their votes like a 3/5 vote or something? What is it? This overt racism from you?
there's some sort of a what you meant to reference, I believe, from those centuries, is the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was a blight on our nation's history, and they did eventually reverse the Chinese Exclusion Act as far as what they wanted with immigration. No, I'm not suggesting that. All I'm is that it will cause some tension if such a thing were to occur. And there are some other interesting questions, such as China isn't allowing for free internet with their country, and they're doing all sorts of questionable human rights things. That's the official term for it, things.
Sure.
They don't let the people use Twitter. So is it okay that the NBA extends this olive branch and is always trying to do business with them and access the Chinese people's voice for this one thing?
I mean, if you're trying to continue to grow the game globally and get even more of a foothold in China to, you know, to make your what will be a $5 billion business into a $10 to $15 billion business, it diminishes the luster of the All-Star game, but at the same time, maybe down the road, it makes everything better for the league monetarily. I mean, I guess that's hard to really judge how effective that strategy is. I mean, is that even something we'll know for the next 10 years?
In terms of my head, I'm secretly okay with not letting China vote on it.
Yeah.
There's too many people over there. There are too many people. Too many people. And the game is here in this country, and I can't believe the xenophobic words that are pouring out of my mouth.
Oh.
I'm just trying to be honest. I don't want to lie to you on your podcast.
You were doing so much better when you were misdiagnosing Vess.
Yes, I was doing better. And so maybe it's not a problem. Maybe the votes won't be there for Lin if he's playing badly and he gets in. But I want Jeremy Lin to be rewarded if he's playing well. I don't want him to be put in this awkward position. I've read enough and talked to enough people who know him. He probably wouldn't want that to happen, to get this unearned praise that puts the spotlight on him. He'd want to earn it. And these wacky things can happen when we have voting access for a population that's much larger than our own, but also doesn't have the same level of access to just basketball media that we have, because they have monitored internet.
Yeah, I mean, I guess a lot of people have a problem with the way the All-Star game is decided, and that goes into it. I mean,
I exclude China. I just want to go with your plan of taking it out of the hands of fans, because we're very much on this highly popular fan-hating, fan-bashing bandwagon, and I just want to do it that way. Everybody gets excluded.
It's really the I feel like the growing trend among NBA bloggers is it's chic now to dislike the way fans talk about the NBA. It's very snobbish and chic.
Well, it's also that I don't believe that these fans who sometimes hassle you or hassle me understand how annoying they are in the aggregate. They just see themselves annoying us or yelling at us or saying that you suck. They don't know what it's like when there are a whole bunch of them and to have that be a constant reality every day. I love what I do. I love basketball. I love writing about it. I'm very thankful to do it. But there is this emotional drain of always dealing with people, not always smart people, calling you all sorts of horrible things because you think one player is slightly better than another player.
Well, all right. I've got two thoughts on that. One, what if we're the ones annoying them?
All the time. I know I'm very annoying.
And two, I found a new strategy for dealing with the people that are like extremely rude and call you names and question your manhood and stuff. I literally just start flirting with them.
Oh, I thought you were going to say I become the manliest man ever.
No, I just start flirting with them and it makes them very uncomfortable.
Oh, that's nice. I think that's a good strategy.
Yeah.
I think that's fine. Maybe I'll use it on this person who's screaming at me for thinking that Kevin Durant is a better MVP candidate than Carmelo Anthony, which I don't know. It just seems like a reasonable position.
I want to discuss that a little bit. Would it be ridiculous? I think part of it is the backlash against New York as a market in that they dominate so much of the news cycle because it's the big market. I don't think Melo has had a better season than Durant or LeBron, but would it be ridiculous if he was considered for MVP right now, if people would give votes to him? I mean, you know, you start getting into the whole idea of what does value mean, what is valuable, who is the most valuable, you know, how do you quantify that? I never think that there's a true, I mean, I think it's rare that there's a true clear-cut winner for MVP. Yeah. And if there are multiple candidates, I'm really fine with any of them getting it.
Yeah, and Carmelo Anthony is probably going to have some ridiculous numbers when this game is said and done. He adds the puck, has 30 points on 15 shots, which is good. I don't know what the statistical breakout is on that, but that's pretty awesome. That's a totally understandable position. I think it's just hard to get people from. It's hard to get people who are arguing with you sometimes to realize that you're not saying that their position is stupid.
Yeah, that's true.
You're wrong. You're just saying I think that Kevin Durant, if I had to choose, is better. But we have to draw a distinction because there are topics on which reasonable people could disagree. And there are topics on which reasonable people can agree. And so if you believe that Raymond Felton should be MVP, then you're an idiot. Well, Anthony should be MVP. Yeah, that's, you know, that's within the realm of normalcy or the realm of, you know, wise.
Sure. I feel like so much of it is how you feel about the market of the player at this point, which I don't like that really getting into the conversation. And you know, that's a natural thing, and that's just a pet peeve of mine, but that's what bothers me. It's like, oh, is the New York story going to drive him into getting more votes? And it's like, well, I mean, maybe. I just think, like, if he is having – if he can keep this pace up all season and the Knicks are a, you know, 55-60 win team, it doesn't seem ridiculous to me that he would get it.
No, but I do think that's real, that market size does inflate your fame.
Sure. Oh, sure.
Those awards. But I also believe that you're right. We, as these snarky, snobby bloggers, we can almost anticipate a dumb reaction and not even give the public any credit and not even allow them to screw up. To just, I remember it was getting that way with LeBron, where all these people within our milieu were going on Twitter and sort of mocking and satirizing this, making fun of LeBron after close games last season. I think the backlash died down a little bit last year.
Yeah.
And it was almost like we like to be in that position of talking down to people, so we almost build a straw man out of it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I think that's definitely – and it is a thing about not giving the person the benefit of the doubt because we do get so many immediate reactions, and that sometimes you're reacting before – you're reacting to something that hasn't even really happened yet, and it's an overreaction, and it's a defense mechanism, and then you become the ridiculous one before the other person has really even stated their point, which is kind of – it's kind of ironic.
Everything's moving too quickly, Zach.
Way too quickly. I was talking about this with Britt Robson of Sports Illustrated, where this immediacy it sucks that when a trade happens, we have to grade the trade immediately. It seems counterintuitive because it is just a guessing game, and you can say it's analysis, but is it really analysis or is it just gambling?
It's just you need to feed the gaping maw. You need to feed someone's need to just react. Have a template. And a lot of the time, you look at the comments, the readers don't even care about us. They just want some launching pad to yell at each other in a comment section.
That's actually fascinating to me. I love that.
Yeah. They don't care. They don't even read it. They just, maybe they'll react to it. Maybe if there's something they don't like, one guy will find it. They'll put it on a message board, laugh at whatever the opinion is. But they want to be writers too. They want to have the conch and argue amongst themselves. And so we're almost ancillary to the process. But to your point about having to have an instant reaction, that's something that I have found annoying because it's not natural to have an opinion about everything. that happens.
Right.
It's this unnatural place, and yet we're always forced to go, what's your take on this? How do you feel about it? And there's no way we can know.
Look at us taking up for the cause of the blogger.
We're stabbing ourselves in the back while at the same time giving ourselves CPR.
You know what this feels like? This feels like the last rap battle in 8 Mile where he just says everything the other guy's going to say about him. Like, I feel like that's what we're doing. This is a preemptive attack.
I feel like you love that movie and you draw so many analogies from that. Well, that's true, and that's a good analogy from it.
I've got to admit, like, there was a time when that movie came out, and then it came out on DVD, where I may have watched it quite a bit because I may have wanted to be a rapper.
I know something about you.
if someone accused me of that, I would not be able to truthfully deny it. Do you want 2 minutes to, before we wrap up, 2 minutes to crow about your Warriors?
Oh my God, it's lovely. It's beautiful. I was crowing about it earlier, but I should get my crows in because the general sense out here is this has to fall apart at some point. This can't be real life. So I'm going to absorb it while it's still around. Man, it feels fantastic just emotionally to have good basketball.
Yeah.
I was trying, like the guy on the airplane in the Twilight Zone, he sees the gremlin on the wing of the airplane. I was trying to warn people that Monte Ellis was just this destructive force on the basketball team who was ruining any kind of aesthetic pleasure that you could take from watching the Warriors, as well as their efficacy. And it fell on a lot of deaf ears. Some people were, you know, some people knew about it, some people followed it, and it was very frustrating to constantly be waging this battle. And now he's gone. And now it's awesome. Now the ball swings around. People pass to open people. Defensive rotations aren't blown. I love it. The absence of Monte Ellis has really ratcheted up what I presumed to be a boring Warriors team and made them fun and somewhat inspiring. I hope it continues. It feels like something must go wrong, but it's great for now.
It does seem that... it's weird that Mark Jackson is such a good coach. I mean, everyone was so down on the hiring, and...
I was talking about this to Danny Noel, or Noel, however you want to pronounce it. That was an instance where basketball Twitter, a reaction was demanded of it.
Yeah.
Everybody was down on it, and I wrote at the time that I was kind of agnostic about it. I don't presume to know who Mark Jackson is. He plays a character when he announces those games. It's not necessarily him. He's not going to go into the huddle and be like, okay, hand down, man.
But wouldn't it be great if that was just how he coached? If it was just little sayings like that, like if his whole defensive speech was hand down, man down, and that turned them into the great defensive bunch that they're becoming?
It'd be a lot like Eddie.
Yeah, which is a great movie.
Yeah, and there wasn't enough even giving him the benefit of the doubt. And what stuck in my mind of what I wrote about was that John Amici came to my college and he had just come out and he was giving a lecture about it. And I believe I asked him, when you raise your hand and ask a question, who's the smartest player that you talk to? Because he said something about players being smarter than they're given credit for. And he said it was Mark Jackson, and that he would have these fascinating political conversations with Mark Jackson about the structural causes of poverty and all these other issues. And it was totally at odds with what my image of Mark Jackson was. And truth be told, I haven't necessarily seen anything out there to back up what John Amici said. But we don't know these guys. They play characters. They put a public face on things. So we shouldn't. We shouldn't act like we necessarily know them from our couches.
And who knows? Maybe end of the year we'll be saying, Mama, there goes that Coach of the Year.
Dude, if we were doing Coach of the Year right now, it's going to be another guy who wasn't given a lot of credit, and that's Mike Woodson.
Yeah, it would have to be, right?
That funny facial hair, it's hard to inspire any kind of reverence. It's not a facial hair of gravitas. But
it's amazing that a guy could, you know, shave his eyebrows for a stretch of his professional career and then grow such a powerful goatee. I feel like somehow the two are related.
He must be on coaching PEDs. Something's going on there for that air situation to crop up. I don't even want to know what causes that.
Yeah, I think it's Propecia.
Oh yeah, well that's.
I think that's what it is.
Razor that solved the problem pretty easily and cut right to the quick.
Well, Ethan, I will stop taking up your Thursday night. I will let you go back to getting hyphy and ghost riding your Warriors.
I am ghost riding my Warriors. Thanks for having me, Zach.
Thanks, Ethan.